Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
He likes to play it cool. He doesn't get too exercised, right? But he really does enjoy good food.
I mean, he was no drama Obama even when it came
when
to
it came
food.
When it came to food, it's exactly right. Like, if it's really good and solid and straight and clean, he's like, that's, he took great, good pleasure.
This week, we're talking to Sam Cass, author and food policy activist. We all first heard of Sam when he became the executive director of the Let's Move campaign initiated by Michelle Obama, which was focused on changing attitudes about food and nutrition in America. He came to the Obama White House in 2009. He has taken some of the lessons he tried to impart there and written a cookbook come gentle food manifesto, Eat a Little Better, Great Flavor, Good Health, Better World. So, Mr. Sam Cass, tell me about life in the Cass family kitchen.
Cass family kitchen.
Growing up.
We had yellow linoleum floors, and some old school, old fashioned stove. Both my parents cooked, but it was pretty typical, well, at least in my mind, typical 80s cooking.
And where are we?
Chicago, Logan Square, when I'm young. And then when I was a little older, my mom moved to Hyde Park. So what do we cook? Very simple, nothing fancy. You know, broiled chicken, broiled steaks, iceberg lettuce salads, stir fries. We did a lot of stir fries.
Well, that's ahead of its time.
Definitely ahead of its time, yeah. That was, my mom did a lot of that.
And were they cooking from cookbooks or just cooking?
No, just cooking. Nothing exciting.
And were you interested very early on in cooking or just eating and hanging out with your friends?
No, actually, I loved to cook from the time I was really young.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. One year, my allowance was based on cooking dinner once a week.
When I
was
I
don't know,
awesome.
9 years old or something, and God bless him for bearing with through that.
And you would,
rough year probably.
Would you cook without a recipe?
Oh yeah, yeah. I don't know. I would just make it up. I remember I cooked this chicken thighs with a bunch of dried herbs, and some onions, maybe some mushrooms that I just sort of threw together. And it came out actually really well. And it was sort of like, I got lucky, I think, because then I tried to do it the next time and put so many herbs, dried herbs in it, that it was basically inedible.
There may be limitations to improvising in the kitchen when you're nine.
Yeah. But I would make my mom like breakfast in bed when she, you know, for Mother's Day and things like that, that, you know, I would have a great time cooking. But it was really nothing fancy, but we always had dinner as a family, and we almost never went out, almost never.
Almost never went out.
Yeah, never.
And was it strictly meat and potatoes?
We would get a little crazy with, like, stuffed pasta shells, with, like, stuffed ricotta shells. That was, like, an awesome thing.
But did she ever really go the extra mile on dessert?
Nah.
See?
Ice cream. But we would get ice cream sometimes.
Like, my mother, we have fruit for dessert. And so my brothers and I would start this chant, ASFD, ASFD, like anything special for dessert.
They did the fruit juice popsicle things, which, you know, looking back on. I was in the kind of family where at lunch I had nothing to trade. Like, you know, it sucked. Like, I had no gummy anythings. I had nothing that was worth anything on the open market.
Celery is not worth shit as a trade.
Applesauce gets you jack shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, it was tough. It was legit tough. Like, I would beg them for something that I could trade with, but no kid ever wanted anything that I had. But it was always healthy, decent. You know, for back then, you know, it was that idea of healthy back in the 80s, I guess.
And were you eating a lot of, when you were old enough to drive or get around on your own, were you eating a lot of, like, Italian beef sandwiches?
Oh, yeah.
And, like,
Al's Italian beef, are you kidding me?
Yeah, all right.
But the thing that we ate a lot of fried chicken, and, you know, because by that point I spent most of my time in Hyde Park, so a lot of Harold's fried chicken with everything.
We should say that Harold's Fried Chicken is a mini chain in Chicago.
It is.
Specializing in pretty damn good, if somewhat greasy, fried chicken.
So good it could kill you at any point, shortly after eating it, but incredible.
That's good.
Yeah, so we ate a lot of that. We ate a lot of ribs and bibs and things like that. Yeah, so I didn't, when I was, you know, middle high school years, well, can't say I was the healthiest eater.
And did you do the double dip Italian beef because you wanted all the gravy?
Oh, yeah, of course, obviously.
All right, so you're
legit. Is there any other way to do it?
No, there isn't, but, you know, I have to ask that question because some people may be a little weird.
Okay, that just didn't even occur to me.
And how did you feel about Chicago pizza? Were you a lover of deep dish pizza?
That's like saying, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe the insanity in that question. Of course. Are you kidding me?
I asked that because when I wrote a pizza book, a book all about pizza, yeah. And in it I uttered some blasphemous statements about Chicago pizza.
Because I'm amazed you're still alive.
Yes. At best, I said Chicago pizza is a good casserole.
Wow. This might be the first podcast you come to blows on. I mean, that is blasphemous, man. To all my Chicago guys, I'm thinking about, you know, doing the deed for you guys. It's just unbelievable.
It was a guy.
These New Yorkers with their, like, greasy, nasty, super cheap garbage pizza that you fold over and think that's some kind of special thing. It's a joke. It's just a joke.
Our thin crust
is better than New York's thin crust.
A lot of people don't know that Chicago does have a thin crust
and
tradition.
And it's a great thin crust tradition.
You know, Vito and Nick's?
Yeah, of course.
And there was, I did discover a lot of different styles of Chicago pizza in researching my pizza book. But I did say I must have had a New York bias, I say, going in.
Yeah, one would think that there isn't a New Yorker without an insane New York bias when it comes to pizza. To the point that you guys are blind to reality. But anyways, it's fine. We should probably move on to other topics because this isn't going well.
So you went off to college. You mm-hmm. went to University of Chicago. Did you think that you were going to get involved in food?
Well, actually, I went to junior college first.
Oh, you did?
In Kansas City, Kansas, to play baseball.
Oh, that's right.
I was trying to make
you had aspirations of being a professional baseball player.
So I went there. I went to a couple junior colleges, and then I transferred to U of C.
Got it. And at what point did you realize that the baseball thing was an unattainable dream?
When I was probably in Kansas City, you know, it started to dawn on me that while I was pretty good, you know, you have to be so much better than everybody at every level to actually make
it. It's true, and that's the thing. That's what happens, because I was a good athlete too, and you realize you reach your level at which you can excel.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like I still had room to excel, and I could have kept going and maybe played a few years of pro ball if I kept working really hard at it, but come out with no education and no where to go. So at the same time, all my friends were at, like, Yale and all getting all these great educations, and I visited a good friend of mine there, and I was just like, okay, I need to get my life together.
Wow, that's crazy. So you started off in junior college playing baseball and realizing that, you know, that you are not going to get where you want to go. And then you transferred to University of Chicago, where it must have been like taking a swim in the ocean academically after junior college.
Yeah, well, in junior college, and this is not an exaggeration, we practiced about 6 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, I was enrolled in four classes I didn't even know I was in. Luckily, you know, I'm sure you're wondering, I did get A's in those classes.
I'm sure. I didn't even have to ask that, Sam.
I know. Everybody was wondering how I fared in those classes. And, yeah, so then I get to U of C. And I'll never forget the coach, first day of practice, said, we practice 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. Thursday is science lab day, so we don't practice on Thursdays. And I was just like, where the fuck am I right now? Like, oh, my God.
That's so great. Well,
this is not going to go. I don't know. I turned to I had one friend who I had known before was on the team. I was like, what did he say? Like, is he serious? So that first quarter was a pretty big adjustment period. But best decision I ever made was to go to UFC.
You know, UFC, of course, is known for the T-shirt that says "Where Fun Goes to Die."
Yes, it is famous for that.
And my brother actually did post-legal work there. And so I lived in Hyde Park one summer.
Oh, nice.
In fact, I almost went to the lab school. Did you go to the lab
school?
Yeah,
I went to the lab. Yeah, my dad taught there.
Really?
For 25 years, yeah.
Wow.
My aunt and uncle taught at the UFC. They were professors
there.
Yeah,
we should say the lab school was this super progressive day school. I don't know if it was founded for University of Chicago professors' kids.
That's exactly why
it
started.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of schools like that all over the country.
Yeah.
You're at the University of Chicago, where they don't let you have a lot of fun. You're playing baseball. And at that point, were you still interested in food?
At that point, it was no more deep than I just loved to eat. I had in my head that one day I would go to culinary school, like later in life, to learn how to cook for my future family-to-be. And I expressed that to a friend of mine who was dating a sous chef of a restaurant in Chicago called 312 Chicago. And so she was, you know, and I got to talking to him about it. And, you know, he's like, don't spend $40,000 a year to go to culinary school. Why don't you just come hang out and just see what you think? And so that's what I did. And so I started showing up. And then the chef, Dean Zanella, wonderful guy, said, you know, if you're going to keep showing up, I guess I got to start paying you. And so he hired me for the summer.
At that point, the Chicago scene was not that fully developed, right?
It was definitely in its first phase of development.
Like Charlie Trotter was
still
there.
Doing his thing, yeah. And Bayless was doing his thing. You know, the people were starting, but it was not the Chicago that we know today, that's
right.
For sure.
And so when you started cooking at the restaurant, did you think, oh, this is what I want to do?
No, never. No, not. I don't know if I ever had that thought. No, I enjoyed it, but it was a disaster. I mean, I didn't know anything. And, you know,
so you got your ass kicked every night.
Every night. And I worked really hard, always worked very hard. And so, you know, that hard work would give me a shot probably before I was ready. So I remember working a couple of lunch services one week. And lunch was their more busy service because it was right downtown. And it was just an absolute nightmare. I could not keep up. But, you know, you start figuring it out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had no business doing that. I was not ready.
So what was harder at that point, hitting a curveball or making an omelet?
Oh, definitely making an omelet. I could hit a curveball, all right. Definitely at that point, making an omelet. But that was just one summer, and I finished school. So I had a couple years left at that point.
And you finished school, and then you talk about in the book, which is a terrific book, by the way.
Thank you.
It's really great. And we'll talk about that in a second. But you ended up going to Vienna. Ended up in Vienna for a semester abroad, right?
Right. So I had one semester left because I transferred, so I just had this sort of last semester. And just wanted to get out of Chicago, and I'd been there long enough and wanted to see the world. And so... Yeah, so I applied to all three. I actually didn't get into any of them. I got waitlisted, and I ended up sort of going into the dean of the abroad program's office and kind of having it out with him and just sort of saying...
That happened to my son, too. He was at Kenya, and they were like, sorry, your grade point average. He's like, I got to get out of Gambier, Ohio. Yeah. I'll lose my mind.
Yeah. My argument to him was that I would make more out of it because, like, a lot of the kids, you know, they sort of... people take things for granted, and... After talking to some of the kids, I had this one conversation specifically with this woman who got into Rome. It was Rome, Bombay, and Vienna, and I didn't care where I went, and she could kind of care less. She's like, maybe I'll go to Rome, and I was so pissed off. And I went in there, and I just said, I promise you I'll make more of this experience than anybody else in any of your programs. And 2 weeks later, I got this letter letting me into Vienna.
That's great.
And so the day I got the third, so I said to the head of the program, so the way it then all played out, was that I said to the head of the program that I was interested in, you know, food. Maybe I could get into a pastry shop or something once a week just to check it out, just to be curious. And then she came back and said, the third day I got there, she was like, okay, so my husband's uncle's friend from college son rides bicycles with the sous chef
okay,
of the best friend.
Okay, you just talked about, that's like a fifth, that's like, I don't know how many times removed that is.
Yeah. But that's literally what it was.
Wow.
And she said, so if you're interested in meeting him, you can meet him on this street tomorrow at 3.
That's great.
And
that's
how it all started.
That's awesome. You know, I went to Grinnell in Iowa, which you know.
Yep, of course.
And I was not a stellar student, but I tried to spend my junior semester abroad in Chicago studying Chicago blues.
Nice.
But they did not accept this as because there was no specific curriculum, and they sort of figured out that I was going to end up spending all my time hang out in blues clubs, right, drinking, and getting stoned.
Drinking and smoking in blues clubs. Perfect.
Exactly. What better junior year abroad than that?
Yeah.
And it wasn't even abroad. It was 300 miles away.
You would be doing the same thing just in Ohio. So
exactly.
You might as well do that in Chicago.
Yeah.
Listen to great music.
So you're in Vienna. You're working at this restaurant.
Yep.
You're getting your ass kicked.
Big time.
But you loved it.
Loved it. Oh, yeah. It was amazing. Yeah, they really, you know, they didn't know what to make of me, the chef and sous chef who ran this great, great restaurant. They're like, you're a well-educated American. Like, why do you want to come cut carrots and get your butt kicked in our kitchen? But if you keep coming back, sure. So, it was just an amazing experience and really difficult. Closest I ever came to quitting something was there. They kind of worked me to the end.
Yes.
But that's how you learn.
But that's also, it sounded like from the book that it was a very traditional, macho, European kitchen.
Yeah, very much. I mean, there was a little more warmth to it than normal, and they loved me. So the chef and sous chef kind of really embraced me as sort of their part of their family. And so it wasn't as kind of nasty, but it was really hard. And they took it upon themselves to kind of beat me into being, you know, a capable cook.
Right.
And they took joy in that breaking.
And so it must have really made your semester abroad.
Well, yeah. And that first semester, I basically didn't sleep. The problem was the sous chef, Alois, who was really the hands-on guy who trained me, was also a complete alcoholic. Loved to drink.
So you were partying until 5 in the morning.
Self-described booze hound. Yeah, there was a number of times where where we were staying was at the last stop of one of the trains. There was a number of times where I woke up back in the city after being on the train to the last stop and then coming, waking up
That's
as
awesome.
The train returned back to the city. I don't tell that story too much. I'd wake up, I'd go meet the chef for breakfast, then we'd go into the restaurant, prepare for lunch service. Do lunch service, then I'd race to class, which was from 2 to 4, go to class completely unprepared, and then race back to meet the sous chef and chef who were having like a coffee or a bottle of wine or smoking a cigar in their little break, and then get back to the kitchen by 5:30 for dinner service and work dinner service till like 11:30 or whatever. And then, then we'd go out drinking.
And then you ended up going back and working at that restaurant, right, after you graduated.
Yeah, so I graduated. I was trying to find a way to get papers, but you can't get papers as a line cook.
Even though they lied to you and they told you they would get you papers, that they knew somebody.
Yeah, so I went back illegally. Yeah, so I was just there illegally. And so there was many, many scams that we'd come up with. There was one plan that I was going to marry the sous chef's girlfriend. So I could stay. So when I came back, I stayed in the sous chef's apartment. He actually moved in with his girlfriend. So I stayed in his room in this apartment with these couple other guys. And I could eat whatever I wanted. And they out of their pocket, they'd give me a little pocket money. But they didn't pay me. So, I worked for knowledge. So we had a plan to marry his girlfriend. I was not fully comfortable with that.
This is not a good idea.
It's probably good that I didn't do that. The minister of the interior had come into the restaurant a bunch, and the owner, not the chef, the owner, who was this kind of TV owner chef guy who didn't know anything about cooking, but he was very arrogant, and so he was like, "Oh yeah, he's my friend. Just email him." And so I emailed him.
And you're escorted to jail.
Yeah, it's like he's like literally the vice president of Austria. And so it'd be like, I'll be like, dear Vice President Biden, because I'm still living in a fantasy land that what's happening now isn't actually happening.
Yeah.
Of course he like forwarded on to the authorities who immediately started calling. So after that was about another year of being there. So a lot happened in between. But yeah, I ended up getting... run out of town, essentially.
And then you ended up traveling and then cooking in a couple of Chicago restaurants, right?
Yeah, I cooked at Avec.
Right, which is one of my favorite restaurants. It's a Paul Kahn and Donnie Medea restaurant that I really love.
One of the greats.
Probably one of my favorite restaurants. And if it wasn't so noisy, it might be my favorite restaurant.
That's fair. It's pretty, it rocks pretty hard in there.
But it's pretty great. But then how did you make the transition to thinking about policy?
Yeah. That's actually started in Vienna. So Alois, the sous chef, had me make a rhubarb sauce for this foie gras dish. And so he said, normally I have to clean this story up, but I guess now I can say whatever I want.
No, it's
great.
Right? It's podcast, man.
Perfect. So good. So he said, okay, they call me Yankee. He said, okay, Yankee, cook the rhubarb down and then fuck in the butter. And I was like, okay. So I cook it down and I take this huge thing of butter and I put it in. He said, no, Yankee. I said, fuck in the butter. And I was like, damn, like, that's a lot of butter. So I take another huge, like, what was an obscene amount of butter and put it in. And he came up to me pissed. And he said, I said, fuck in the butter. If the guest walks out of this restaurant and drops dead of a heart attack, it's not my problem. The guest asked me to make the food taste good, not to make it good for them. And he was totally right. And it's kind of in an elegant and powerful and kind of shocking way. Summed up a big part of the problem that we're facing, which was we had been asking chefs and the restaurant industry and the food industry to make food that tastes good and not to actually have much thought for our health. We just sort of assumed that maybe there was something, we weren't thinking about it. And so I went back to my station really rattled by that, because you could see out into the dining room that a lot of people were sick. And you started looking around the street and you realize, like, because of the food that we're eating, you know, people are really suffering. And then right after that, one of the purveyors came in carrying like all the chickens and ducks and eggs and stuff. And I immediately said, okay, well, what are the implications of the food that I'm preparing for the people I'm serving it to? And then what are the implications of the food I'm preparing on the people who are producing it and on the land that it comes from? And so once I kind of asked those questions, and that was like really early on. That was like soon after I'd come back.
And they were probably at that moment, it was probably hard to get answers.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot. You know, I started doing research. I stopped reading cookbooks. At that point, I'm like pouring through cookbooks. Every night I'd go home, I'd read cookbooks trying to learn.
And what year we're talking about?
So that was like 2003.
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah, so I just started reading policy books and, you know, like Marion Nestle's book.
Right.
And like some of the old school writers who had forged a path.
Food from a Small Planet, yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, yeah. And weird taxation books and history of agriculture books. And so that sent me down on that path. So by the time, you know, and as I sort of traveled for the next 4 years or five years in, about in total, came back a little for a year or so, a little less than a year to work at Evec, that's what I was really focused on it by that point.
And then how did you get from there to working for the White House?
Yeah, so part of what, so I cooked at Evec for a year and then I went to New Zealand. Oh my God, I can't.
Right, as a private chef.
As a private chef, was cooking for a family down there. Sort of cooked and traveled my way around the world and came back and I was going to cook for them part-time and actually organize chefs around food policy. That was what I was trying to figure out how to do when I came back to Chicago.
So that was really your jam.
In 2007, yeah. That was what I was trying to do. But I have no idea what that meant. Like, that wasn't happening yet. And so the family I was cooking for ran into Michelle on a flight and had known them from, you know, previous sort of political world.
This is Michelle Obama.
Michelle Obama, yes.
Right.
Sorry. And I had known them just from Hyde Park, being at the lab school and being in that neighborhood. Not super well, but definitely knew them. And yeah, got reconnected and then Senator Obama had just announced his campaign a couple months prior.
The longest of long shots.
The longest of long shots, yeah. And so I started. She had no help. It was just like grandma. You know, there was not like a big staff or anything. So
you were just cooking at their house.
Yeah, so I just started helping her out a couple times a week. Yeah. Yeah, and back then I would cook, you know, for that. I'd come in and cook and then I'd leave a plate, you know, plates for the next night that she would reheat.
Right.
Which is really funny to think about now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because that's the way most people I knew that used private chefs is they would come in once or twice a week and make three meals.
Yeah. That's what I was doing, basically.
And did they appreciate good food even back then?
Oh, yeah.
Were they
serious
about it? Like, are they serious eaters?
They're very different. They like and love really good food. You know, she's quite adventurous and, like, I think she takes a different kind of joy from it than he does. He really, really likes good food, but he's not plussed about it. He's not like, he doesn't get too, he likes to play it cool. He doesn't get too exercised, right? But he really does enjoy good food. But he doesn't like fancy stuff.
I mean, he was no drama Obama even when it came
when
to
it came
food.
To food, it's exactly right. Like, if it's really good and solid and straight and clean, he's like, that's – he took great good pleasure.
Now, my friends who have eaten with them and my chef friends who have cooked for them say that Barack has a serious Jones for pie.
He does. That's correct. That's a fact I can confirm.
That's not under NDA.
No, it's not.
And when he went to Seattle, my friend Tom Douglas would cook coconut cream pies for him and even put some in his limousine. And he'd always like send or have somebody send him a note that love that coconut cream pie, man.
I don't know. I can't confirm that, but that sounds totally believable.
And so what did Michelle eat that Barack wouldn't?
She has a very public love with French fries. He didn't eat a lot of French fries. You know, he's like, we're similar like that. Like, I'll have a couple fries, but I don't like eating a lot of fries. He doesn't eat a lot of fries.
And so, okay, so you're cooking for them in their house as they're running for president. Did you think there was a chance in hell that you would be cooking in the White House?
You know, when I started, like, I had a sense that nothing was going to be the same again. But even through that summer, like, he had no traction, you know, and into August, into September, he was 30 points down in 2007. So, you know, we had faith in him, but, you know, his name was Barack Hussein Obama. He was a black guy living on the south side of Chicago. Like, you know, I think we had a little too much cynicism to think that it was really going to happen. But, you know, we were dreaming about, you know, if it did.
Right. And did they say, you know, if we do this, if by some miracle we do this, would you come with us?
So Ms. Obama and I had lots of conversations around food and health and nutrition and, you know, what was going on in the country and how parents were struggling. And we dreamed of what we could potentially do together on those issues if we did. So there was a sense from her vantage point that, you know, if that happened, she'd want me to come. That conversation was never broached with him until he won.
Right.
And I had actually applied to NYU's food studies program.
Oh, you had?
Yeah. And she,
we used to hire interns from there all the time at Serious Eats.
Yeah, and Michelle had actually wrote me the recommendation for it.
That's awesome. That is probably the best goddamn recommendation you could have.
Yeah, I was pretty confident I was going to get in. and it was funny. when then President-elect Obama came in, and it was like I was cooking. He just walked in and he was like, basically just offered me to come. He's like, we were thinking it'd be great if you came. If you're interested, you know, let me know. But I know you've gotten into grad school, so that sounds pretty good. You may very well might want to go there, you know. It's a tough opportunity to turn down, and who knows how this is going to go. And I was like, are you crazy? Like, what are you talking about? Yeah, no, I'm coming.
What do you call them when you're in the White House? Like, you must have called them Michelle and Barack before you got there.
Yeah, and privately I did and still do. But when you're around other people, or typically on a podcast, you call them President or First Lady, you know, President Obama, First Lady Obama. First Lady, yeah, like that.
Was it intimidating to be there?
Yeah, it was scary as hell. Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, there's just nothing in life that can prepare you for that. Even people who are in Washington know Washington. Going to the White House is just different than anything, any other job in any place ever, anywhere. And so you can have basic tools that, you know, and talents and skills that will serve you well there. But nothing prepares you for that job, really. Yeah. And for me, you know, I was not a creature of Washington. So it was all new. And I'm a cook, you know, trying to do some big things. So that was a whole other level of intimidation or challenges that, you know, I think most cooks coming into that place wouldn't have even been thinking about. But, yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it's just chaos, especially in the beginning. It's just chaos. you know, nothing's organized. Nobody knows where the bathrooms are. You don't know where the fridge. I didn't know where the fridge was, where the chicken would be. You know, it's like you're starting at, you're just from a, you know, fire hose on every level. The head chef, Chris Comerford, who's actually still there, wonderful, wonderful chef.
And a Filipino-American woman. Yeah.
Wonderful chef, even better person. She handled all the state dinners and all the banquets and all that stuff. I mean, I would help, but that was her show, and it was a show for sure. I mean, watching her and all of our team pull that off was just incredible, considering all the constraints. But yeah, so no, I did family dinner 5 nights a week, and I did, you know, then I started working on the garden and then all the policy stuff and let's move. So those were my other jobs, which took up, you know, the vast majority of my time there.
So let's talk about the policy stuff. So like, what did you do that you're the most proud of? And like, what was the biggest lesson you learned?
I think what we were able to do, and I was very conscious of sort of as the primary goal going in, was to take the issues of food and health and how we're feeding ourselves and the implications of how we feed ourselves and take those issues, which when we got there were largely being sort of having advocates scream at the food industry and the food industry say we're not doing anything wrong and nobody really listening to them at all, and putting these issues in the mainstream culture in a language that everybody could understand and elevating the importance of our food and all of those implications in a powerful way. And that we absolutely did in ways that have been transformational to the country that she'll never really get credit for.
Right.
And when you think about change when it comes to food, there's a lot of focus on policy, and we should talk about policy, and we did a lot on policy. But food is ultimately the deepest expression of who we are and of our culture. These aren't issues that can be fixed through policy for the most part. And our policy is a reflection of our culture. Really, our culture is the underpinning of the problem. And so addressing our cultures, changing culture is the hardest thing to do. There's nothing harder, especially in food, and you got to be careful because food is our traditions. It's how we show love. It's how we understand who we're not and who we are. Like, it's very complicated. And so taking that on in a way that I think was meaningful and measurable was really important. You know, on a policy level, transforming school nutrition was probably our single biggest policy thing we did. But we also transformed the way the industry has been dealing with this. When we got into the White House, industry literally wasn't talking about this in the boardroom. They did not have any care for health at all, and definitely not sustainability. And now it's top of line for every
single company. Because they realize that is the future because everyone is thinking this way.
Yeah, and we kicked their butts in a pretty public way. We called the First Lady, called them out in a very public and aggressive way early on. She went to speak at their a conference of theirs and really put them on notice. To the point where they were not happy with me in particular. And they also, you know, part of what's also happened is that, you know, in a generation that grew up with lots of writers and people speaking out and all this other stuff, and also the White House really caring about these issues and planting eggplants on the South lawn and things of that nature, it's now second nature to them. And so for younger generations, it is their culture. Eating healthier, eating with the planet and climate change in mind, that is the culture. And it's starting to shape our broader culture. And that's a legacy that's really powerful. And so, you know, so now the industry is scrambling to try to figure out what the hell are they supposed to do. They don't know what to do. They don't have any ability to innovate. They don't have very much of an authentic voice to say we actually really care about this, because until not that long ago they didn't. So some of them are doing a good job, I think, and a lot of them are not. But it's changing the way we eat, and
sure.
I think that's a good thing.
I think that's fair. It's always going to be a two-step forward, one-step back process. And I guess if you didn't know that going in, you quickly found that out.
Yeah, for sure.
Thanks, Sam. You're going to stick around for more conversation for another episode of Special Sauce. Okay. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.